This is Retirement Lifestyle Advocates Radio. I'm your host, Dennis Tuberg, and glad you decided to listen in today. Hey, joining me on today's program is the editor of Gold Newsletter, Mr. Brian London. He is also the producer and host of the New Orleans Investment Conference, the world's largest investment conference. I'll be getting his take on the economy and the investing markets in segments 2 and 3. But first, since this is the last Sunday in March, the last week in March, I'd like to give you an opportunity to get this month's special report, which is the Little Black Book on Social Security Maximization. If you are approaching the age at which you're thinking about collecting Social Security and you want to know how to maximize your benefits from the program, I would invite you to visit requestyourreport.com and request your copy of this book. This book is about 120 pages. It's a quick read. It's to the point, and it'll help you maximize your benefits from Social Security. So go to requestyourreport.com. Let me know where to mail that book, and I will be very glad to do so. You know, if you're watching the news over the past couple of weeks, depending on the news source that you pay attention to, we had the politicians in Washington that just passed another massive, largely unfunded spending package. And of course, this was to avert a shutdown of the government. Now, this massive spending package was passed despite the fact that debt excesses are one of the biggest threats that our economy faces. And when you dig into this bill, which we've had time to do at this point, we find the reality is it contains prolific levels of pork. Money that is being spent that arguably should not be spent. And of course, this spending will add to the already unmanageable level of federal debt, but that has become business as usual for Washington. And of course, in keeping with what has become a common legislative practice, the bill was introduced in the dead of night, 3 a.m. on a Thursday morning, just 48 hours before the deadline to get the government funded and avoid a shutdown. So there wasn't time once again to read this bill. And it was not a short bill. It was a monstrosity. It was 1,012 pages to be exact. It contains 6 of the 12 bills that Congress has to pass each year to fund the government, and it came with a price tag of a little more than $1.2 trillion. The other six bills, that were needed to fund the government were already passed earlier in the month of March and came at a cost of $465 billion. That means that during the month of March, both houses of Congress authorized spending of between $1.6 trillion and $1.7 trillion at a time when the federal government is adding to the level of national debt at a rate of $1 trillion in new debt every 100 days. Now, both spending packages passed in March contained a lot of pork. In response to the first spending package, the nonprofit group Citizens Against Government Waste named Senator Chuck Schumer as the porker of the month for the earmarks he got inserted into the first spending bill. Now, the group announced this not very esteemed award for Senator Schumer on its website by saying the following, quote, "In the Transportation, Housing, and Urban Development Bill alone, there are 7 earmarks worth $12.4 million for 2 museums and 25 earmarks worth $30.7 million for bike paths. Senator Schumer got $6.7 million for museums in New York City, one of which had $354 million in income in 2022. Members of Congress, like Senator Schumer, use earmarks as legalized bribery to get votes for the appropriations bills in exchange for morsels of pork barrel earmarks." The president of Citizens Against Government Waste, Mr. Tom Schatz said, quote, Senator Schumer is feeding at the trough and shoveling out billions of dollars in earmarks to members of Congress. Earmarks are one of the most corrupt, costly, and inequitable practices in history. This excessive spending will only further add to the fiscal burdens on taxpayers. Senator Schumer should instead be working to reduce waste, fraud, and abuse and mismanagement. For his efforts to push expensive pork barrel earmarks, Senator Schumer was an easy choice for this month's porker, end quote. Now, if we turn our attention to the most recent 1,012-page bill that passed, there are a number of earmarks in that one as well. There's $850,000 for a gay senior home. There's $15 million to pay for Egyptians' college tuition. There's $400,000 for a gay activist group to teach elementary kids about being trans. There's $500,000 for a DEI zoo. That's diversity, equity, and inclusion. There's $400,000 for a group that gives clothes to teens to help them hide their gender. Now, without making a political statement on these earmarks, the reality is our country's finances have decayed to the point that austerity should be the number one concern of lawmakers, but instead, reckless spending continues. So the question, of course, is who will pay for all this spending? As per usual, you and me, and maybe not the way you think. Maybe not directly through tax, but almost certainly through inflation tax. You see, if the federal government runs a deficit and they can't find buyers for all the U.S. government bonds that will be issued to finance this out-of-control spending, we have seen in the past that the Federal Reserve becomes the ultimate buyer of these bonds. They become the buyer of last resort. And they use newly created currency to buy these bonds. And I don't need to tell any of you who've been out shopping over the past few years that currency creation leads to inflation. And should it continue, we will see inflation continue, perhaps even at a higher, more painful level. Now, on past programs, I've commented on the official inflation rate, which is reported as the Consumer Price Index. Now, the truth is the Consumer Price Index, the reported official inflation rate, doesn't look a lot like the actual consumer price inflation that each of us experiences. The Chapwood Index is a measure of consumer prices, and it's a private index. In fact, the founder of the Chapwood Index has been a guest on this radio program a couple times in the past. The Chapwood Index tracks what consumers actually pay for 500 different items in 50 different U.S. metropolitan areas. That measure of consumer prices has seen an average annual increase of 11% to 13% over the past 5 years, depending on which part of the country one lives in. Now, these numbers, in my view, could end up seeming rather mild if the current spending trajectory continues. And based upon what I have been talking about in this segment, it seems as if it will. Now, in one of my recent Headline Roundup newscasts, which I do every Monday live at noon Eastern, and if you'd like to check out this newscast, all you need to do is go to retirementlifestyleadvocates.com to get more information. You can also participate live. I offered on this Headline Roundup newscast a quote by Austrian economist Ludwig von Mises. He commented as to how all this will ultimately end. And I quote, "There is no means of avoiding the financial collapse brought about by credit expansion. The alternative is only whether the crisis should come sooner as a result of voluntary abandonment of further credit expansion or later as a final and total catastrophe of the currency system involved." In other words, If the U.S. government were to stop spending currency that it doesn't have and balance the budget, we would have a financial crisis. The financial crisis in this case would be deflation. On the other hand, if the U.S. government keeps spending more than it takes in from tax receipts, and the Federal Reserve becomes the ultimate buyer of last resort of these U.S. treasuries, and they create currency from thin air to make the purchases, then the currency will be severely damaged or fail. That now seems like the likely outcome. I'll talk more about this in the next segment with my special guest on today's program, Mr. Brian London. If you would like to get the March special report, the Little Black Book on Social Security Maximization, visit requestyourreport.com and let me know where to mail the report. I'll be back after these words.
Welcome back to RLA Radio. I'm your host, Dennis Tubergen. Joining me on today's program is returning guest, Mr. Brian London. I'm always excited to have Brian on the program. He is the editor of Gold Newsletter. You can learn more about Gold Newsletter at goldnewsletter.com. And he is the producer and host of the New Orleans Investment Conference. You can learn more at neworleansconference.com. Brian, welcome back to the program.
Great to be here, as usual.
So, Brian, let's jump in. We'll talk a little bit about the really amazing history of Gold Newsletter before we get through this segment. But there is a lot going on around the world. We have debt levels at record levels. We've got gold breaking out to new highs. Silver looks like it's about ready to break out. We have the BRICS countries definitely accelerating this whole de-dollarization a movement that's going on. So is 2024 the year this all breaks loose in your view?
Yeah, I really think so, Dennis. And I think it already has to a very large degree. You know, gold has, since really the last day of February or, you know, the first day of March, has embarked on a truly amazing rally. It's up, you know, about 6% over that time span. And you know, as we speak over the last few days, it's actually down a little bit. So it's done even better than that. And for no apparent reason. I mean, even the top experts out there are admitting that you really can't point to one single precipitating factor for this big rally in gold. And generally speaking, you have to look at it that gold is sensing something ahead, or it's reacting to what's been a gradual trend in debt, in some uncertainty about that payback, et cetera, and perhaps foreshadowing the fact that the Fed has to cut rates simply because the debts out there are too large right now to have interest rates at these levels. So it's a number of things, but the fact that there's not one single easy answer for why gold has rallied is, I think, a sign that this rally has, you know, more legs on it, is more fundamental, and is real. And we're starting to see the reactions not only in the gold mining stocks, but also in silver, which has actually outperformed gold during this rally. And that's a key sign of a rally that is secular in nature and is long lasting and has as its root monetary concerns. And so I think 2024 is the year for gold and silver in particular and associated investments. And I think it's already begun.
So Brian, if I could, let's drill down onto something you said. You said the Fed is cutting rates because there's simply too much debt to be financed at higher interest rates. And yet in the whole scheme of things, interest rates really, if you look at the last 40 years, interest rates are probably below the average. You know, the U.S. government, just to drill down on that, is adding $1 trillion in debt every 100 days. That's obviously a trajectory that can't continue. And yet, how can the U.S. government sell debt at lower interest rates when we're such a bad credit risk? Doesn't that mean the Fed's going to have to step in and print no matter what they call it?
Yeah, they will eventually. You know, if you look at the history of interest rates and the Fed funds rate, if you go back to the early 80s when Paul Volcker just started to lower rates after he had raised them really, you know, over 20% to kill off the inflation of the 1970s. It's about a 40-45 year trend of ever lower interest rates. If you trace the bottoms of each interest rate cycle, it's a steady stair step down. And until 2008, they had to go to zero. And in addition, they had to invent things like quantitative easing and a bunch of other programs to rescue the markets, rescue the economy, protect the banking system, et cetera. So they increasingly had ever easier money, and then they had to come through with some extraordinary rescue efforts. Then came COVID, and they did everything they did after the 2008 great financial crisis, but they did it in a blinding speed and to a much greater degree. Everything that took them 4 to 5 years after 2008, they did it in literally 4 to 5 days as COVID broke out. So what we see is that it's not only a trend of ever easier money, but it's a trend of ever more extraordinary rescue efforts with each crisis or each slowdown, because the markets and the economy have become addicted to that drug of ever easier money. That means that it's also developed a tolerance. And every time you inject the drug average, you have to give more of it to get the same effect. So that's why when this next crisis comes, which always happens as the Fed overreacts in one direction and then the next crisis that comes, what they are going to be forced to do to get the markets to react is really just going to blow your socks off. You won't believe what they're going to have to do next time. And that day is coming, because ever lower interest rates also encourage ever greater debt accumulation. And of course, in politics, there's a natural tendency for politicians to spend more and more and borrow more and more. It's a basic human tendency that we've seen throughout history. And they did that. And the federal debt is growing right now at an alarming rate. And what is the solution we see from Washington? Increasing spending by 15 to 20% as the latest proposals have come out. So the debt is growing at an ever faster rate. And in addition to that, because the debt is so large, interest rates, even at these levels, which are, you know, the treasuries are now rolling over to about a 4 to 5% rate, interest rate. That means that the bottom line cost of servicing that debt is soaring. And it just recently passed the threshold of $1 trillion a year. So in addition to a deficit of, say, $2 trillion a year or thereabouts, we're adding another trillion that just goes to pay interest in the federal debt. And where are they getting the money to pay that interest? They're borrowing it, and they're borrowing it at these elevated rates. So it is essentially a debt spiral that I think can create a very big problem, even for the country that issues the world's reserve currency. We are in a debt spiral that would take down any other economy in the world, save the United States, because it is the one that issues the global reserve currency. But that's coming under attack as well. And at this rate of at this decline in this debt spiral, it's going to have a big effect even on the U.S.
So, Brian, as you were talking, and these treasuries are now rolling over to higher interest rates near 5%, the research I've done says that we've got $8.6 trillion of debt that has to be rolled over this year, and I'm talking U.S. government debt. Mm-hmm. And in addition to that, we've got another $1 trillion in commercial real estate loans that are maturing and are going to roll over to higher interest rates. Seems like just those two statistics are a recipe for what could be a perfect economic storm.
Absolutely. And you're absolutely right about the commercial real estate. It's just under $1 trillion this year that's going to roll over. And these are companies that were having trouble, that were essentially zombie companies when interest rates were near zero, when they were paying 2-3% or 4% on their loans, and now they're going to be refloated and refinanced at, you know, 8 or 9%, because the banks are then, they're not just going to rewrite or those loans at higher interest rates. They're going to look at the underlying collateral as well. And if the collateral has dropped 15, 20% in value in a commercial real estate market that we see as, you know, is in big decline, then they're going to demand either higher rates or not even write those loans. So it is a tsunami that's just off the coast that's going to hit eventually. And it's not anything like, you know, it doesn't take a genius to forecast this kind of a thing. You can see it coming. We all see it coming, and it's just simple math. So when we see talk that the Fed really will leave rates like this, they won't cut rates for some time because they see that the labor market is still somewhat buoyant. They don't really have a choice. This tsunami is going to wash on the shores of the U.S. economy. Commercial real estate loans, the federal debt, et cetera, no matter what. And they can't ignore it. And even though they say it's really not their purview to regulate that or to take that into account, they can't ignore it because it will crater the federal budget eventually. And it will definitely send the U.S., I think, into recession once those loans are come due. And we see a lot of these zombie companies that, of course, just give up the ghost and finally go bankrupt.
So, Brian, we've got about a minute and a half left in this segment. Tell the listeners about the New Orleans Investment Conference. You can learn more at neworleansconference.com.
Yeah, you know, Dennis, it is the longest-running investment event in the world. This is our 50th anniversary this year. It was all started by my friend and mentor, Jim Blanchard, in the early 1970s to teach U.S. investors and savers how to buy gold. You know, it was illegal to own gold back then, and Jim was instrumental in getting gold legalized. So then he decided to have a conference to teach people how to buy gold. And it's gone great guns ever since. We've had many of the giants of history, from Ayn Rand in her last public appearance, Margaret Thatcher, Alan Greenspan, Milton Friedman. The list goes on and on and on. And in recent years, we have been featuring some of the most insightful commentators, in my view, on the macroeconomic picture out there. And they're coming again. We're going to have a gala celebration this year with some special speakers and special events for our 50th anniversary. It's held in the fall each year here in New Orleans. And this year, it's November 20th to 23rd. And it really is a can't-miss event. One of those things you really have to experience to believe it, to understand it. And once you come, you want to come back.
Well, my guest today is Mr. Brian London. He is the producer and host of the New Orleans Investment Conference, the editor of Gold Newsletter. And I'll continue my conversation with Brian when RLA Radio returns. Stay with us. You are listening to RLA Radio. I'm your host, Dennis Stuberg, and I have the pleasure of chatting today with the producer and host of the New Orleans Investment Conference, Mr. Brian London. You can learn more about that conference at neworleansconference.com. And Brian is also the editor of Gold Newsletter. You can learn more at goldnewsletter.com. And you mentioned in the first segment, Brian, that your friend and mentor, Jim Blanchard, founded both the New Orleans Investment Conference and Gold Newsletter. Tell the listeners a little bit about, Gold Newsletter.
Yeah, Jim Blanchard started it in 1971, literally on the day that Nixon closed the gold window, which means he severed the convertibility of dollars into gold from foreign nations. In 1933, FDR essentially confiscated everyone's private gold and made it illegal for U.S. citizens to own gold. But in the post-World War II economic environment and the Bretton Woods Agreement among all of the industrialized nations at the time, nations could turn their dollars that they got from trade with the U.S. into the U.S. Treasury and demand gold in return. Well, these nations, particularly Charles de Gaulle in France, realized that because of all the overspending that the U.S. government had done, for example, in guns and butter regime of the 1960s, that the dollar really wasn't worth its what we said its weight was in gold, and the dollar was much cheaper. So he and others began to turn their dollars into the U.S. in exchange for gold out of Fort Knox. So in August of 1971, President Nixon stopped that and just unilaterally abrogated the treaties and the agreements and said that dollars would no longer be convertible into gold. Jim, hearing this, knew that there was going to be a wave of inflation coming up because dollars would get ever cheaper because there was no longer any restraint on the issuance of those dollars. Unfortunately, at the time, it was illegal for citizens to own gold, so he started something called Gold Newsletter as a way to advocate for the return of gold legalization. And he did a lot of other crazy things. He had a biplane tow a legalized gold banner over Nixon's inauguration, something that would get you thrown in Guantanamo Bay today, of course, but he got away with it back then. He began holding press conferences around the country where he would hold a 2-ounce bar of gold that he had smuggled in from Canada and dare the Treasury Department to come arrest him, which they unfortunately declined to do, but still it got the point out there. And through his efforts in lobbying in Washington, they were able to get the gold legalized through a bill that passed on the last day of 1974. So in advance of that, Jim had his first conference in New Orleans to teach people how to invest in gold. That became the New Orleans Investment Conference. And Gold Newsletter evolved into a market commentary newsletter, which I continue today. And it is the oldest precious metals advisory in existence, longest running, and probably even the longest running investment newsletter still in existence. So those are two legacies that we are very proud of, and we try to burnish those legacies every day and deliver great value to our readers, subscribers, and clients.
Well, Brian, I want to read a quote from Ludwig von Mises, which I talked about on the program about a week ago, and I want to get your reaction. He said, "There's no means of avoiding the final collapse of a boom brought about by credit expansion. The alternative is only whether the crisis should come sooner as a result of voluntary abandonment of further credit expansion or later as a final and total catastrophe of the currency system involved." And I want to ask you, do you agree with this Austrian position? And if so, which alternative do you think we'll see?
Yeah, Dennis, I do agree with it. If you look throughout human history, every economic regime, every currency has eventually collapsed, even when those currencies were based on gold and silver, because they would still debase those currencies by either diluting the amount of gold or silver in the coins while actually clipping the edges, making the coins smaller, etc. Again, as I alluded to earlier, this is basic human nature. It happens over and over again. Governments overspend their means. In ancient Rome, it was bread circuses and military campaigns and entitlements, actually, for the citizens that caused them to debase the Roman denarius. And if you look at the chart of the debasement of the Roman denarius, the loss of its purchasing power, it perfectly mirrors that of the U.S. dollar since the 1960s. So again, this is nothing new. It is, in our case, a 40, 50, 60-year trend that has come about through deficit spending beginning in the 1960s. And it's going to come to a head at some point. The fact that we're seeing these economic crises more frequently and with more severe reactions by the Federal Reserve and other central banks is a sign that I believe the water is circling more quickly around the drain. And we are getting closer to the end of this process. We are in the end game of this process. But There's no telling whether it's going to be the next crisis or the one after that or the one after that. So there's no telling whether it's going to be 5 years, 15, 20 or more. But at some point, we are going to see fiat currencies, not just the dollar, but currencies from all the major developed economies, because they're all doing the same thing and have been doing the same thing. We're going to see faith in currencies be degraded to a point where they have no more credibility with the public that's using those currencies. So how do you very quickly and immediately and assuredly regain credibility in a currency? You attach it to something that acts as a governor on government's ability to create ever more quantities of it. Throughout human history, that one thing has been gold, and that's what I think we're going to end up with at some point, some sort of a reattachment of currencies to gold. Now, that will necessitate a repricing of gold, because there's so many, in the dollar's case, there's so many dollars out there and so relatively smaller amounts of gold that the gold price will have to be $10,000, $15,000 or more to back even 20 or 30% of the amount of U.S. dollars in circulation. The thing a lot of people don't realize, though, is that you could multiply the price of gold in one fell swoop overnight and not disrupt a single industry on the face of the planet. It is the only commodity where you could do that, because its usages in industry are not that extensive, and where it's used in such minute amounts that the price really has no effect on the end price of the product. So gold is, imagine that, the perfect money. And I think we are going to get back to that stage, to that point, at some point, because it always ends up there, and it has always ended up there throughout human history.
Brian, I'd like to, you mentioned a time frame. I don't know if this is going to be 5 years, 15 years, 20 years. You know, you have the BRICS countries now that are, as I mentioned at the outset, that are, according to them anyway, aggressively pursuing an alternative currency. Rumors out there, and there are rumors at this point, you can correct me if I'm wrong, have this currency potentially linked to gold. Do you really think, given the current trajectory of currency creation and debt accumulation, that we can go 15 or 20 years before we see some type of a reset? Or do you think it might be a little bit sooner than that, given, as I mentioned, some of the things going on, particularly with BRICS?
Yeah, I actually, it may surprise you, I think we can actually go on toward the longer term. I think 15, 20 years is probably more like it, maybe even more. You know, when you look at gold as, not gold, but the dollar as the global reserve currency, there's two ways to look at it. One is the purchasing power of the dollar relative to things, and the other is the purchasing power of the dollar relative to other currencies, other fiat currencies. They're really two distinct things. I think that there is a trend toward an abandonment of the dollar eventually as the global reserve currency, but I don't think it's a trend that we really need to worry about overmuch right now, because it would be so long-term in nature. You know, we can argue and criticize the legal regime and the rule of law in the U.S., and globally, but it's still the best rule of law in the world today. And more than anything else, I think that's important to a currency's use as the global reserve currency. Now, that said, the one effect that it's having right now, because of the U.S.'s use of the dollar as a weapon, you know, with the sanctions in Ukraine, et cetera, because of that, we are seeing other nations buy more and more gold. Russia, of course, exchanged all of its treasuries years ago for gold. China has been buying gold hand over fist both as a officially as a central bank and also domestically by its citizens. And we're seeing a number of other central banks buying gold at record or near record levels. Central bank gold buying set a record in 2022. It totaled just below that record last year, and it's continuing apace this year. So that's one of the big trends that's been supporting the gold price and supporting this new bull market has been the underlying bid in the market from central banks. And it's a bid that is not price sensitive. So it keeps coming in. They don't care that gold's gotten more expensive. They're just filling an allocation over time to build up their gold reserves. So that's been the primary impact of this de-dollaration move to me is not so much an abandonment of the dollar or a hastening of that trend, but a hastening of the trend toward gold and more gold buying. That's been the primary result of that de-dollaration trend.
Well, my guest today has been Mr. Brian London. He is the editor of Gold Newsletter. You can learn more at goldnewsletter.com. He's also the producer and host of the New Orleans Investment Conference. You can learn more at neworleansconference.com. Brian, always a pleasure to catch up with you. Thank you for joining us today. Love to have you back down the road.
Same here, Dennis. Always a pleasure, and I hope to be back on whenever you like me.
Well, thank you very much, and we will return after these words.
Welcome back to RLA Radio. I'm your host, Dennis Tubergen. Glad you're listening in today. Hey, and thanks again to my special guest, Mr. Brian London, for joining me on today's program. If you have not yet gone to requestyourreport.com to request your free copy of this month's special report, which is actually a copy of my best-selling book, The Little Black Book on Social Security Maximization, I would encourage you to do that. Go to requestyourreport.com, let me know where to mail the book, and I will be glad to get a copy out to you right away, absolutely free and with no further obligation. You know, those of you who do look forward to a comfortable retirement may have seen the report that was recently released by Senator Bernie Sanders. It was titled A Secure Retirement for All. Now, I don't have a lot in common, to be completely transparent, with Mr. Sanders when it comes to opinion on public policy. However, I found the facts that were brought to light in Senator Sanders' report to be very interesting. The report found that half of all Americans age 65 and older are living on less than $30,000 a year. That's remarkable when you think about it. The report also stated that half of all Americans are at risk of a financially insecure retirement. That's up from about one-third of all Americans just 40 years ago. So the prospects of a comfortable, stress-free, secure retirement are fading for many Americans. Now, the report, Mr. Sanders' report, offered up solutions that I could have predicted without reading the report. Mr. Sanders refers to these proposed changes as strengthening the Social Security program. Change one proposed by the senator, put more money into Social Security, which Sanders calls the most successful program in our nation's history. And change number two, force workers to save for retirement via payroll deduction, then offering those workers a guaranteed monthly income at retirement. Now, as many of you longtime listeners know, I am a bit of a history buff. And since Social Security began, changes to strengthen the program have been made. Many of these changes have been made. I'm going to talk about just a couple of them. Ironically, whenever a change is made to strengthen the program, the outcome has always been making the program weaker. Now, I'm not sure if Senator Sanders made this connection, but describing Social Security as the most successful program in our nation's history is almost delusional, given that, based on the last Social Security Program's trustee report, Social Security is underfunded by nearly $60 trillion. Now, the reality of this program is that while inarguably it has benefited many, many retirees, to call it the most successful program in our nation's history is certainly not true, since the program has been thoroughly mismanaged by the collective group of Washington politicians over the years. That's not how one would describe or define a successful program. Now, interestingly, Mr. Sanders is suggesting forced savings through payroll deductions and a guaranteed lifetime income later in life. That's exactly how Social Security was defined at the program's inception nearly 90 years ago. What Senator Sanders undoubtedly means is more forced savings. That means higher taxes and more income at retirement, which may or may not happen. It seems Mr. Sanders wants to do more of what got us here to attempt to remedy retirement poverty. I believe it was Albert Einstein who was credited with the saying that the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again while somehow expecting to get a different result. Now, the harsh reality is there is no money to strengthen the Social Security program. You know, if you go back and look at Social Security, when Social Security started, the tax was 1%, and you paid 1% of tax on the first $3,000 in wages, and you retired at age 65. But at the time, the average life expectancy of an American was 61. It was the perfect political scheme. But then changes were made to strengthen the program. Disability benefits were added in the 1950s. Inflation adjustments to your Social Security benefits were added in the 70s. And by the time inflation adjustments were added, Social Security taxes were 5% rather than 1%. Today, they're 6.2% on the first $168,600 in wages. So Social Security is purported to have a trust fund. And you should get the Social Security book to get more on this at requestyourreport.com. However, when you read all about the trust fund on the Social Security's website, it says this: tax income is deposited on a daily basis and invested in special issue securities. The cash exchange for the securities goes into the general fund of the Treasury and is indistinguishable from other cash in the general fund. That means Social Security's trust fund doesn't really exist. It exists on paper, but the Social Security Administration's website says the cash is exchanged for these securities. The cash goes into the Treasury and is, quote, indistinguishable from other cash in the general fund. The Social Security program has been around for 89 years this year, and it seems every time changes have been made to the program, taxes have increased, and so have the unfunded liabilities of the program. More of the same will likely get you more of the same. Now, that said, I want to close this week by offering again my little black book on Social Security maximization. You can get that by visiting requestyourreport.com. The website, again, is requestyourreport.com. Just let me know where to mail the book, and I'll be very glad to send it out to you at no cost and with no further obligation. Thanks for listening. I'll be back again next week.